This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This past weekend, more than 200 people attended the Portland Troublemakers School to learn techniques for holding employers accountable to union workers. One of the guest speakers was Mark Brenner, director of Labor Notes magazine. Here he is speaking on new directions for labor.
What I'm here today to do is to talk to you a little bit about the tough times we're in and how we can breathe some life back into this labor movement of ours. It's not news to anyone in this room that we're 5 years into the biggest economic crisis of our lives. Employers and the politicians that they've got in their back pocket are using this economy as an opportunity to try to wipe unions off the map for good. Whether it's gutting collective bargaining rights in Wisconsin or railroading right-to-work laws in Michigan, it's clear that they won't stop until they've erased everything that we have won since the Great Depression. But as much as they preach that we're all going to have to make do with less, that there really is no alternative to the cuts and the austerity, as many times as they point their fingers at school teachers, lunch ladies, bus drivers — I know some of you bus drivers are in here today — and blame you guys for the mess that we're in, we know it's all BS. I mean, the problem with our economy is not government deficits or teacher pensions. It's the fact that whether you work in the public sector or the private sector, if you've got a union card in your pocket, then you've got a bullseye on your back. Right? The battle lines right now couldn't be any clearer. Last year, corporate America hit the lottery. I mean, I'm not talking about the mega millions, we're talking the mega trillions. $2 trillion in corporate profits. And the Wall Streeters that got us into this economic mess with their wild speculation and the liar loans, how much did they get? $20 billion in bonuses is what they took home after driving our economy off the cliff. And whether it's GE, Boeing, UPS, Kaiser, they're not coming after concessions because they have to. They're doing it because they can.
That's right.
Right? You know, sometimes I kind of hate to admit it, but I'm like, I kind of admire their chutzpah. You know, it's like, you know, you crash the economy. Did you apologize?
No.
Did you promise that you wouldn't do it again? Hell no! They double down on the same free market fairy tales that got us into this mess in the first place. And almost without noticing it, they pulled the biggest bait and switch in our nation's history, probably in any history. How did we go from a situation in 2008 where everyone, I mean everyone, knew that it was the Wall Street bankers, the CEOs, and everybody in their zip code who put a wrecking ball to our economy, to a situation today where teachers, lunch ladies, and bus drivers are the greedy public employees who are really the problem? Like, how the hell did we get in such an upside-down situation, right? We live in the richest country in human history, right? And they're telling us that it's too much for workers to make enough money to stay out of debt, get decent health benefits, have a few weeks of paid vacation, and have a pension we can count on when we retire. What kind of BS is that? I mean, you've heard it a million times. There's no money. We're broke. Whether it's Republicans like Chris Christie in New Jersey, right next to where I live, whether it's Democrats in California like Jerry Brown, everyone from the State House to the White House is singing the same tune. But just because they say it a million times, you know, that our country's broke, doesn't make it true, right? The dirty little secret, the thing we need to always keep bringing the conversation back to, is that our country isn't broke, we're swimming in money. It's just in the wrong people's pockets.
That's right.
Right? Now, for some reason that I still cannot quite explain, I get invited very regularly to go on Fox News.
Whoa.
And I know, it's like, what are you thinking? But when I start talking like this on Fox News, the commentators, they throw up their hands and, oh my God, that's class warfare, right? It's funny, when our employers cut our wages, destroy our pensions, and gut our contracts, they call that the free market, right? If this is class warfare, what I'm talking about, we need a lot more of it.
That's right. Yeah.
I see I'm in the right place. All right, good. 2 years, we've gotten a glimpse of what that might feel like. From the Capitol Dome in Madison to Zuccotti Park, ground zero for Occupy Wall Street, people have been standing up or sitting in, putting democracy back on our agenda, right? Even the labor movement has got us a little swagger back, right? I mean, you heard Sarah Chambers this morning talking about the Chicago teachers and the fight that they're in with Rahm Emanuel, the murder mayor, over the future of public education in Chicago and elsewhere, right? But it's not just folks in the Windy City. You guys have to check out Labor Notes magazine, back cover, story about coming out of the Twin Cities in Minnesota. Right. It's an amazing story about what janitors there accomplished this year when they linked up with Occupy activists and other community organizers in their town. But like their brothers and sisters in Chicago, the janitors in the Twin Cities, they didn't stop at their employer's doorstep. They took their fight straight to Target, Wells Fargo, and the rest of the bankers and the billionaires who actually run the Twin Cities, and together, they won what was impossible to secure standing alone, right? We're even seeing non-union workers get into the act. I live in New York City. We've got 2 fast food strikes under our belt in the last 8 months, right? We got sisters, where are you? Our sisters here from Seattle, who are from Walmart, right? Where they're also standing up to strike. So, you know, I've been a union activist for 20 years. And I'm gonna tell you that the things that we're witnessing over the past 2 years, they get me more excited than any time in my union career. Now, you guys are probably sitting there scratching your head saying, we just spent all this time talking about the economy and the, you know, the fact that they're coming for us, they're steamrolling us in right to work. So, you know, how the hell can I stand up here after rattling off all the bad things that are happening to us and say I'm so excited? Well, to be honest, it's not because things are easing up. You all know this. The challenges we're facing are multiplying every day, right? And it's not actually because I think we're going to win the fights that we've got in front of us. You know, look at our history. We lose most of the fights that we're in. In fact, I would say everything we've won that was worth having, there were a string of defeats in front of us before we actually won it, right? It's what one of my friends, Eve Weinbaum, calls a successful failure, right? You lose and you lose and you lose until you win, and then often you win big. So keep that in mind, which I try to. But the reason I'm excited, there's 3. First, the alarm bells are finally ringing in Union HQ. I mean, yes, it's uneven. I know there's plenty of labor leaders that still got their head in their sand, but more than I've ever seen, union brass is open to new ideas. They're more willing to experiment, and I will even dare say they might be willing to change more than I've seen in 20 years. So, you know, I think we've hit the tipping point among the stale, male, pale labor leadership, particularly in Washington, that they finally realize the same old is a one-way ticket to the dustbin of history. Right? And that's a good thing. Now, I know most of our good ideas probably aren't even getting a hearing in the halls of power yet. And I know that people are still running around chasing after the new shiny thing. But look, I've been in this game a long time, and I can tell you, chalk this up as a win. We're going to run with it. The second reason I'm really excited is because the troublemaking wing in the labor movement, you guys, we're growing. Right? Whether it's the teachers in Chicago or the pipe fitters and steam fitters here in Portland, members have made it clear that they're hungry for a fighter in their corner, and they're willing to brush aside existing leaders who won't stand up or can't stand up, right? Mark my words, this trend is going to continue. And that's why Labor Notes is doing troublemaker schools like this all around the country, because we're growing, right? 2,000 people this year alone will be doing what you're doing right here. We're off to a bang-up start. The third reason is because of Occupy Wall Street. It's never been clearer in this country which side we're on. It's us versus them. The 99% versus the 1%. Now, it's easy to wag our finger at our business agent and our union president, even Rich Trump, the head of the AFL-CIO, but if we want to change the world, we got to be organizers, right? And as organizers, we got to be clear about a few things that we've got to get a hold of and keep in front of us if we're going to put some movement back in this labor movement. I'm going to give you my 9-point program on that, right? I ran out of gas last night, so I only have 9. So the first one, it's about power, right? Getting more for us, for our coworkers, for our communities, and leaving less for the people who are currently calling the shots on the job, in the legislature, in our economy. Now, this is an unfortunate fact for the union suits in Washington, because no amount of jawboning, whether in the halls of the legislature or at the bargaining table, is going to change that, right? There's only one way out of this mess, and that's tackling the upside-down economy head-on. And there's no question the deck's stacked against us. If we want to have any hope of winning, we can't play by the rules. We got to break them.
That's right.
And it just so happens that there's an article in this issue of Labor Notes that you got in your pocket. A strategy based on strikes means breaking the law by our very own Joe Burns. So, we got to break the rules. Number two, members have to be first. Being union doesn't mean a damn thing if we continue counting our dues dollars in our bank account, the square footage of our buildings, or the number of legislators who are willing to suck up to us for some campaign cash, right? Being union is all about the members. That's where our power comes from, right? We say it all the time, you are the union, right? But it can't just be talk, right? We have to walk the walk. Members are not in the driver's seat in most unions in this country, and until they are, we actually aren't ever going to really be doing organizing. Best case, we're going to be mobilizing people to something that they didn't have a hand in creating. Worst case, we're just demobilized, which is the fact that a lot of us are facing, all right? So in order to actually get things moving, point number three for me is you got to start on the job, right? That's where most union members spend most of their time, right? It's great to put a pro-worker politician in the legislature. What happens the other 364 days out of the year? What are we doing to win for our members, for our co-workers, day in, day out? That's where it's got to start on the job. That's where our power really emanates from. Number four, we cannot win if we don't build leaders. Exponentially more leaders than we've got. Hundreds, thousands more leaders, right? It's member to member, organizing. That it's going to take leaders in a structure that allows them to determine the direction that they want to take and put plans in motion, right? So to actually let leaders lead, we need to deal with point number five, which is our movement's incredible democracy deficit, right? If you want people to actually be in charge, be in the driver's seat, you got to give them the space and the time to figure out how to do it. Sarah, I don't know if you mentioned this, at their delegate assembly, after 5 days on the picket line, they come together, they get contract proposals from management. Do they vote to go back? No. What did you do? You took 2 days on the picket line for members to read the contract that they had negotiated to decide whether or not this was good enough to go back to work over or whether to keep striking, right? You've got to give people the time and the space to make decisions. Otherwise, you are not functioning democratically. Now I'm going to get into some scary terrain for most union leaders, right? We got to name the system. The system that we are in is called capitalism.
That's right.
It works because people make profit off of us, off of our work, right? And that is the reality of the world that we're living in. And it's not just any kind of capitalism. We are in the most audacious, greedy, effed up version of capitalism that this world has ever seen, right? And what we do about that, we can debate, we can discuss. The movement, that's why we're in a democratic organization. But the fact of the matter remains, that is the reality that we're operating under, and we got to be able to call a spade a spade. And this one is a really ugly MFN spade. Number seven, we've got to aim high, right? People are not going to put their jobs, their livelihoods, their families, their homes at risk over a nickel an hour, right? We got to be actually aiming for something a hell of a lot more ambitious than that, right? To me, it's about actually changing the world that we live in, right? It's about actually making the world look more like what I want it to. The people in Chicago that went out on strike with the CTU, they didn't do it just over, you know, some particular aspect of the contract that they cared about. They were talking about educational apartheid. They were talking about the fact that if you're black or Latino in the city of Chicago, everything that you get out of the public school system looks completely different than if you're white living in the neighborhood that Barack Obama lived in, right? That's the difference. And we got to aim high if we're going to actually inspire people to take the risk that we need them to take to win. Number eight, there are no saviors No silver bullets and no shortcuts to this. Look around the room, right? It's a DIY movement. Nobody's going to ride in on a white horse and fix your problems. There's no one thing that's going to work. Ask Sarah about how it worked in Chicago. There were no shortcuts. It was, what did she say to me last night? It was a bunch of people willing to do a hell of a lot of work to talk to their coworkers, to get them on board with what needed to happen, and then to put it in place, right? No shortcuts. Last thing is, this is a long distance marathon, right? We are in this for the long haul. What we're doing right now, the work you're doing in your work site, the work you're doing in whatever fight you're in, that is laying the groundwork for what's to come, right? Openings aren't always going to be there, but when they are, we need to be there to take advantage of them. So we got to be troublemaking for the long haul. That's why we're here today, to sow the seeds, to get the skills, to get ready. So put on your track shoes and let's get out there.
That was Mark Brenner, director of Labor Notes Magazine, speaking on New Directions for Labor at the Portland Troublemakers School on Saturday. Coming up next, Economic Update with your host, Richard Wolf.
One of these days, things gonna change.
One of these days. Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update. The biggest news this last week was Social Security. And after much advance publicity, President Obama revealed to us that, yes, it was true. He was going to propose cuts to Social Security. It's a little complicated because what they're doing is changing the rule whereby they calculate how much your Social Security should go up each year to take account of the rising prices we have to pay for the goods and services we consume.